I was born and raised in New Jersey, the northern part of New Jersey no less, but I'm proud to have been called an honorary Southerner. I say proud because the more time I spend there, the more friends I have from there, and the more I know the South as a complex, difficult, and beautiful place, full of stories. We think it's traditional, but it's always changing. We think it's all about barbecue, but it's also rice and peas and corn. And we think it's all about black and white, but it's also yellow and brown. This week, we're all about unexpected stories about the South. Secret curry kitchens in South Carolina, a chef in Seattle fighting fried chicken stereotypes, oh, and hippies. John T. Edge is one of the sharpest thinkers on Southern food we have, and that's one of the best laughs you'll ever hear, because when you really get him going, which isn't hard, it's his full porcine snort. And that laugh is an important part of what he does. As the director of the Southern Foodways Alliance, he sets up Southern food as this big, inclusive tent, one that welcomes and honors and ties together people of all races, politics, and walks of life, which is not easy. But a big, endearing laugh has got to help. So when I found out he was writing a food history of the modern South, I knew it would be smart, sensitive, and challenging. What I didn't realize, though, is that his book, The Potlicker Papers, would be so full of surprises. It's got stories of a furious Colonel Sanders, driving around in a Rolls Royce with his own face on it, cursing at what his food had become. It's got stories of the gospel star Mahalia Jackson lending her face to a fried chicken chain to help build wealth for black franchisees. So we asked John T. to come in to talk about some of those surprises. John T., great to have you here.
Thank you, Francis.
So let's talk about your book, The Potlicker Papers. So the book is a history of the South told through food, and starting with incredibly powerful stories during the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, stories that literally made me cry. But what I want to talk to you about are people we don't necessarily associate very often with the South. And when we think of hippies in the 60s and 70s, we think of California, we think of Woodstock. But you write in the book that there were these huge and hugely important hippie farming communities in Tennessee and other points in the South. Tell us about them.
Well, if you think about that moment during the Civil Rights Movement, when it was made clear by way of protests, demonstrations and the like, that the South might be a place to quit. The South might be a place to leave. The Great Migration had been drawing people north for generations. In that very same moment, the Back to the Land movement catches traction. And one of the places that the long-haired hippie freaks, and I say that playfully because that's the way they were spoken of with disdain, one of the places that the men and women of San Francisco traveled to was the American South. So Stephen Gaskin of San Francisco, who was a Marine Corps veteran, taught these Monday night classes in the Haight-Ashbury, and he helped his followers kind of channel Eastern religion and Western religion. Gaskin began to draw a crowd for a Monday night. By the height of it, he was drawing 1,000 people who listened to him and ultimately followed him to Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Gaskin has a vision, though. He says that the cities are part of the problem. And as the drugs intensify and crime intensifies, Gaskin says we must quit the hate and we must go east. And in 1971, he's speaking before his amassed faithful about the promise of the world beyond the cities. He said, the worst thing happening on the planet is the cities. Like, the cities are the major cause of warfare, poverty, totalitarian police state, whatnot. All those things are functions of being crowded up in cities. And he says, after the services, the caravan is to take off to Tennessee and get a farm. Because what you put your attention into, you get more of. And I need more trees, more grass, more wheat, more soybeans, more healthy babies, more good-looking, sane people, people that can work.
But why, like, what did the South mean to them? Because, I mean, if they just wanted to go trees, I mean, there are plenty of trees in California and somewhere between California and Tennessee.
True. There was a kind of mythology of the South for that generation. The American South was a place they believed untrammeled. The American South was a place wherein their kind of naive fantasies about going back to the land could be best accessed. The American South was kind of the root of all things American, a kind of primeval land where they believed that they could reattach the tethers between their lives and the lives of their forebears.
It's so interesting because there's this, you know, Southern food in so many ways, I think, has become sort of our national regional food, where so many things that we think of as being classically American have roots in the South. And it's so interesting to think that that idea is bigger than just the food. I mean, there's this myth almost of the South as being sort of a purer America. And so they get there and they have these farming communities. How did they interact with their neighbors, and how did they influence their neighbors and their neighbors influence them?
Stephen Gaskin and his followers at the farm came South because they appreciated the agrarian lifestyle that was possible in Tennessee. And they saw value in the men and women they met. There was an intergenerational connection there. These were young people in their 20s and 30s, and they befriended people of an older generation, people in their 60s and 70s. This was a moment in the American South also when the Foxfire books came to the fore. A teacher in North Georgia assigned his students to go visit with their elders and learn how they skinned a hog or how they made lye soap. And that intergenerational connection that the Foxfire books engendered was the same sort of exchange that Stephen Gaskin and his followers aimed for. They wanted to learn the old ways. They wanted to learn how to farm with a mule and a plow. And they saw the same appeal in those kind of connections that they did when they like dropped the needle on a Joan Baez album and recognized that when she sang Butcher Boy, it was borrowed from Appalachian hollers and Appalachian songs.
Right. And about the stuff that they were growing and eating, you wrote that these were largely vegetarian communities. And certainly much of Southern food is naturally vegetarian, but this is also a place that, you know, worships the pig. So did their diet, was it weird? Did they influence people around them? What were they eating, and how did they... Because you also write that these communities actually have far-reaching influence that we still feel today.
Yeah. I mean, the first crop they adopted was a crop already resident in the American South, in that part of Tennessee, sorghum. So they raised sorghum and harvested the crop communally. There's a beautiful picture in my book of these long-haired kids standing around pulling in the sorghum harvest. And they marketed that sorghum. They came up with labels, sold them in stores around town. Beatnik sorghum was the label under which they sold it. And that became, you know, they knew how they were perceived in the community, and they played off of it. They were honest about the exchange, which was, to me, kind of beautiful. They recognized that, you know, the communities around them found them odd. You know, this was a moment when, after the Tate and LaBianca murders, and this is a moment when people saw long-haired hippies and thought, oh my gosh, this is some kind of cult that's come to visit us. And Gaskin and his followers were as open as they possibly could be and were wide-eyed and almost beatific in their approach to these elders and said, teach us, we want to learn.
And at the same time, they also turned around and I think you invented like nutritional yeast and started making commercial tofu.
Yeah.
Tell us about those kinds of innovations they made.
Well, Gaskin had a vision that soybeans were kind of the future tense food. And along with growing sorghum, they began to grow soybeans. Gaskin and his followers were really innovative. They conceived one of the first commercial soy ice creams, which they called Ice Bean. And they also began working on tempeh using sweet potato slips. These innovations were the way they paid the bills. These were commercial enterprises. The farm was self-sustaining for the longest time, and the farm and the people who lived there thought that the way they would sustain their community was by way of agrarian beliefs and agrarian knowledge.
Oh, that's interesting. I love that they had to invent, they had to innovate. So they integrated themselves in terms of the people, but they couldn't integrate their economy necessarily. So they had to create things like soy ice cream.
And they tried hard to integrate within the community. There's a great scene in the book wherein people from the farm and a Pentecostal church nearby gather to have a joint service. And those moments, which were quite intentional on the part of the farm, they had deep respect for their neighbors and wanted to communicate that by talking about religion in an open format. One of my favorite parts about that in researching that moment in the farm's history, I found an article in the Tennessean, and when you look at the byline, it's Al Gore Jr.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was a Cub reporter.
Oh, man, so that's the beginning of Al Gore's career, too. So much started, so much began over there in the woods of Tennessee. Thank you so much for coming in today, John T.
My pleasure, Francis. Thank you.
John T. Edge is the author of The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South. I love talking with him, as you can probably tell, and you can find more of our conversation in our podcast feed. We talked about a rageful Colonel Sanders and Mahalia Jackson's role in the fried chicken business, and that's coming soon to your podcast queue.